Hello, and welcome to another episode of Must See Matches. It is our second Bret Hart SummerSlam match in a row, which delights me. I am Kieran, and potentially delighting the man behind Must See Matches, Mark Buckledy. Mark, how's it going with you?
Yeah, I'm good. Chilling out, playing lots of Zelda and going to lots of book events, basically, of all things.
You seem to have a nice week off.
It was nice to have only my fourth day off this calendar year.
This week, we have fast-forwarded 1 year from last week, and we are talking about Bret Hart versus Davey Boy Smith from SummerSlam 92, August 29th, 1992, in Wembley Stadium. It seemed pertinent to do it around this kind of time, seeing as there is currently talk of wrestling returning to Wembley Stadium this year. And joining us to talk about this is Twitter's favourite wrestling historian, Alan Cheapshot. Alan, how you doing?
I'm doing well. That's tall praise. Wrestling's favourite. I might not go that far, but I appreciate the plaudits nevertheless, Kieran. It's good to be here.
Every day you tweet something I had either forgotten about or didn't know. It's fascinating, the on this day stuff you do. I really enjoy it.
Oh, thanks. I kind of done quite a lot of it in the past, so I can recycle things because it's always relevant on that day. So I can look, what did I post 3 years ago? Oh, I can do that again because it still applies. So yeah, it's an easier gig than it was when I started it about 5 years ago.
It's always new to somebody.
Yeah, exactly.
So I have to ask you the main question, the main SummerSlam 1992 question. Were you there?
Alas, no, I wasn't. In 1992, I was 10 years of age, started being a fan of pro wrestling about a year before. So I was in that initial boom period. It was in London. I was up in the Northwest. If your family aren't really into it as much, so I didn't have Sky. We got it taped off one of my dad's work colleagues, a lot of the shows that were on Sky Movies at the time, the Sky Sports. So it wasn't something where, oh, let's go down as a family. So unfortunately, no. I was very envious of this. And future shows in the UK, another one that springs to mind a few years later was the original Sabu show in Walthamstow. That was another one that who was there? And there's still people knocking around the internet. There were these shows. What about yourself, guys? Did either of you attend?
Mark, I think I know the answer from you. I'll let you go first.
Definitely did not. This is a bit that I've not told before. My intro to wrestling as a thing was around this time period, but it was from some of our neighbors talk, because they had Sky, so they would talk about wrestling storylines, and occasionally I'd go around and play with their action figures. But it took me about 5-6 years from that conversation to me actually ever seeing wrestling, which was in 1999. So the short answer is no.
And like you, Alan, I also didn't go, but I lived only 10 miles away from the stadium.
Oh, what's your excuse then?
I would have been 13 at the time, and like you, like my family weren't into wrestling. Like I was the wrestling fan. I was watching WCW on ITV. We didn't have Sky. I don't know what my awareness would have been of this show at the time. I know that sounds crazy to think, like, you know, it's an 80,000 person show at Wembley Stadium, but it's like, I wasn't watching WWF. Like, to me, that was cartoon nonsense, and I preferred watching quote-unquote the real wrestling I was getting in WCW on ITV every Saturday.
Yeah, no, I was in a similar boat, so I was very much more in tune with the WCW footage that you could get. You know, a lot of it at that time in 92 would have been bashed around the schedule, 2 a.m., 1 a.m., 3 a.m. It was hard to keep track at times, but different regions showed it at different times. That was what, you know, the state of play was up at Granada anyway.
Yeah, we at least got it on a Saturday afternoon in a fairly regular time slot. They tried to like match it to the old World of Sport time slot as best they could usually.
Oh, well, we had soccer with Elton Wellesby, you see, at that time in Granada. So no one was moving for Elton Wellesby. So in 93, yes, we had it. So I could kind of follow William Regal's rise when he joined the promotion early in 93. But no, in 92, it was still very much bouncing around late night in Granada. But still, that's what I would get Video Plus for. Remember, do you remember Video Plus, guys?
Yes.
Because it was a lot easier to get the code off the newspaper to put it in to record it than it would be to kind of work out the antiquated timer on your VHS recorder.
I never got that. So my recording VHS basically was down to, I've got a 3-hour tape. If I start at midnight, then this show that will be at 1 a.m. I'll still catch. I've just got a minute, an hour of rubbish before. But for me, it wasn't wrestling. That was more anime on the Sci-Fi Channel with my random mix of Evangelion and whatever else was on before or after.
So this show, I mean, it remains the biggest show ever held in the United Kingdom. Mr. Khan is attempting to break that record later on this year. The WWF cites a figure of 80,355 that Vince brings up a couple of times. Per Big Daddy Meltzer on the Wrestling Classics board, he said, the quote is, "The real number at Wembley per WWE's official records is 78,927 paid and 79,127 total in the building." I think once you get into numbers that big, you're kind of splitting hairs because, like, you know, you're talking a difference of maybe a 1,200, 1,500 out of 80,000 people. Regardless, there is a ton of people in the building. There is no other way to put it. It's fucking rammed and it looks amazing in the wide shots, even like when this match goes on in darkness.
Yeah, no, it looks awesome.
I think this is... because I believe that WrestleMania 3 was a smaller attendance,
yes,
the legit number. So yes, this is the largest attendance of any match that we're covering on the podcast.
Ah, do we not do anything from Dallas Mania?
No, that was 32, wasn't it? Which is the official biggest attendance.
I don't remember.
No, I don't think anything. I had a quick look, actually. I haven't got numbers to hand, but I had a look at the highest legit attendances, and we're not covering any of those WrestleManias.
Interesting. So I think this is going to be a bit of a question for Alan. What is the backstory? Vince is doing the old brothers-in-law fighting, it's tearing the family apart shtick on commentary, but what was the actual TV story? I don't think I've ever seen any build for this match.
Yeah, so originally, kind of just to take a few months back, WWF were originally running in Landover. That's where SummerSlam, that's the site of SummerSlam where it was going to be. It was around, at the time we record, probably about this week actually, that on TV, they actually announced that they're running Wembley. So it was a shift from, it was going to be Shawn and Bret was the rumoured match at SummerSlam. And then what kind of they looked at was the numbers, the declining numbers in the US from a pay-per-view standpoint. They wanted another stadium show. They wanted to show that they were still successful despite kind of what was going on behind the scenes with the various kind of legal wrangles that they had at the time. So they had WrestleMania 8. That was, you know, it looked good still. It looked like a big show, a hot show. And I think they still wanted to follow that on the next pay-per-view. So it made sense. Plus the fact that business was a lot stronger in Europe than it was in the US at that time.
Yeah, we're heading into the period where they're doing multiple European tours a year, aren't they? Because business is about to slide in the US.
Yeah, and I think a big thing that no one speaks about is the power of video games at that time. And there's a video game that maybe wasn't that popular because it wasn't on every platform, but I distinctly remember there's European Rampage as a video game on like the Amiga and the Atari.
It wasn't popular because it's really bad. I had the one before it. I had WWF WrestleMania for the Amstrad CPC. It was the first game I ever speed ran. I could finish it in 3 minutes and 35 seconds from first load to final bell, where you get shown the newspaper headline of you, quote, winning WWF.
Well, you wouldn't the whole promotion, so I don't think Vince would be too happy with that, would he?
But if you did it with Ultimate Warrior, it didn't say Warrior wins WWF, it says Ultimate wins WWF, which is one of my favorite grammatical wrangles ever in a sentence, I think. Particularly in just three words.
Yeah, so it started around May, where the decision was to move to SummerSlam at Wembley. The popularity, like I mentioned, with, you know, even releasing a very poor video game, they were trying to just release that for the European market, and I think that was a smart idea at the time. So it pretty much started where Bret had the runner's champion. He was beating all comers. He's on TV saying, I'm top dog here, and it was very much a kind of Bulldog said to Bret in an interview, I'm interested in wrestling for the title. It was all very lazy, not I won't say lazy booking, but very paint by numbers. There was nothing that stood out. There was no major confrontations on TV. There was a lot of kind of interviews on the podium between the two, hosted by the various hosts at the time. But there was nothing that really stood out from a, this is the match, this is the angle to be build the match, such as, you know, Diana. Diana was the angle, really, wasn't she? So the dynamic was, Diana was in between the two. Who would she choose? Who would she love? Who would she fall out with between her husband and her brother? So that was, you know, pretty early on in the build was kind of the story that made the match what it was. It was more sold on, this is Bulldog. This is in the UK. This is his big chance. And we've got someone that's very, very popular in that market as well. So I think it didn't really need a strong storyline. Its storyline kind of was the circumstance of the time with the venue.
Yeah. It almost didn't need an angle. Like, you put Davey Boy Smith on top with pretty much anybody, you're going to get a good attendance. But if you put him on top going for a title, like, you're going to sell the place out.
Yeah, it was pretty much written in the stars, this show. It peaked at the right time. You would look at WWF's popularity after this. Whilst they went into 93 and there was still, you know, interest and there were still tours in 93, I definitely think this was arguably the peak because the media behind the show was pretty big. A lot of the tabloid newspapers were running, you know, articles on WWF, introductions to WWF, kind of middle page spreads, getting to know the wrestlers. And
was this the year of the Burger King ad as well? The Davey Boy Smith Burger King ad, yeah.
Yeah, the very wooden Burger King ad as well, if you remember that one. So there was a lot of promotion in the media about this. It was something different. It's still, in those days, if you remember, guys, anything American was still exotic.
Yes.
And it felt like it was so more advanced as a country than we were. Looking at it now, you know, I would rather be, you know, a British citizen than a US citizen for quite a few reasons. But at the time, you know, you dreamed of going to high school. You know, it looked just so cool being an American. Anything that was brought over here that was a tinge of Americana, people ate it up.
Yeah. And Davey Boy was one of ours who had made it over there.
Yeah. Which was not really told. No. As well as maybe it could have been, because he'd been with the promotion since, well, not full time, because he went back to All Japan and did some other bits, but he's first in WWF in 84, wasn't he? He brought over from Sam Stampede. So, you know, by this point in 92, whilst it wasn't a full 8-year run, he had 5-6 years in the promotion and a number of years where he was on major pay-per-views, WrestleMania 2 being the best example of that. And, you know, paired with the likes of Ozzy Osbourne, who was a big star. So he had a little bit of a legacy, and so did Brett, but they never really played into that too much with these characters.
No, it's interesting. Like, it happened a lot around this time. I think they don't talk about these guys having a tag team past at all. They've always just been wrestlers. They're just like singles people within the company. No, and I mean, they don't talk about their individual teams, let alone the long rivalry the two teams had. And you'd think today that would be something would be a hook to hang this on as well.
Yeah, I think there's missed things that could, you know, give a good backstory. But WWF were always like that. They would repackage people, you know, even if they had the same name, you know, they've got a slightly different look. Bulldog. Yeah. In 92 didn't look like Bulldog in, you know, 87.
No.
I think he was actually smaller in 92 if you look at the match that we're going to talk about. But yeah, definitely different haircut, different tights, similar for Brett as well. And then you had other examples where, you know, he just slightly changed someone's name, so the Dragon rather than Ricky Steamboat, but it was basically a new character. there was no mention of he was a IC champion, maybe on commentary by some of the commentators now and again, but it was never really pushed that this is the same person, even though obviously it was.
Mm. So these guys between them, like, they've been wrestling each other since at least 81, starting obviously in Stampede through New Japan, WWF Tag Division, and even once they both left the WWF after Montreal, they had one match in WCW, Bret and Lex Luger versus Bulldog and Jim Neidhart on an episode of Thunder. my point is, though, they knew each other exceptionally well. So Brett's story from his book is that Smith had been on a weeks-long crack bender with Jim Neidhart, and Brett only managed to catch up with him the day before the show at the mandatory entrances rehearsal. And he says he drilled the match into Smith over and over until Davey could recite all the spots back to him. And then come match time, they're a couple of minutes in, Brett's got a headlock on, and Davey famously goes, "I'm fucked, Mr. Hitman. I can't remember any of it." And Brett has to guide the whole thing, telling Davey what to do and when, even down to the facial expression to get them through it. And the quote I liked was, every time Davey picked me up, I went up like a feather. Every time he went up for me, it was like lifting a full refrigerator. I don't really know where to go from that. I mean, if you don't know, you don't know, I guess, watching it. I mean, obviously, like, they're tired towards the end, but, like, you really have to, I don't know. Davey's kind of blank-faced for a lot of this, I think. Mm. And that's where it tells that he's not quite there.
Quickly, I assume that both of you watched this match for the first time without knowing that.
Oh, yes. So I would have seen this on VHS. Probably once I really started getting into wrestling. So maybe, like, which would have been a couple of years after this happened. Yeah.
Yeah, same with me.
Were you aware of this when you started watching it, Mark? Did you know the legend before you?
Yeah, you had told me the story before. I'd actually seen the match. So I'm kind of looking for this from the get-go. Very quickly, because I think this is one where we could quickly get going, is this is, of course, our fourth time seeing Brett. Davey Boy had 7 matches nominated. And until I remembered that the 1992 Royal Rumble was a thing, every match he was nominated for had a Hart in it. So it was whether he was wrestling Owen Hart, or it was the Canadian Stampede match, or even as random as the 10-team Survivor Series 1987 match.
Brett's not in the 92 Rumble, is he?
Yeah, that's the only match. Yeah.
Nominated. And Owen's not a thing at that point, really.
Yeah, that's the only match nominated for Davey Boy that doesn't have a Hart in it. And Brett doesn't even have a match on that Royal Rumble.
No, he was, the official story is he was out with a flu, I do believe.
103 degree fever or something ridiculous like that was part of commentary, yeah.
Yeah.
The other random stat, Davey Boy's 7 matches that he was nominated for were in 4 different countries.
Mm-hmm.
He had a match with Owen in Germany on Raw 199 in 97. He had Canadian Stampede. He had this match in the UK, and he had multiple matches in the US.
Mm.
Do you want to guess the one wrestler that I know for a fact was nominated to have matches in 5 countries?
Oh, I have a suspicion it's going to be somebody awful we don't talk about anymore. It's going to be somebody like Jimmy Snuka or Chris Benoit, isn't it?
No.
Wow.
Vader.
Interesting that you'll say that, but I won't say why. But it's not Vader.
Gone.
It's Walter.
Oh.
He had matches nominated in OTT, WXW, the UK, USA, and Japan.
Huh. And is he top of the heap when it comes to that kind of stat?
He's the only person that I can find that was nominated for matches in 5 countries. That doesn't mean that there isn't someone else, but I check the usual suspects. And
now, I know obviously we have more Brett to come. Is this, until we get to the 92 Royal Rumble, is this the only Davey Boy Smith match we'll be talking about?
Yeah, the Royal Rumble from 92 is the only other match with Davey Boy Smith in it. And we probably won't be talking about him a lot when we get to that one.
I don't know. I think he had a decent showing, because I was thinking about, you know, how there wasn't much of a build for this, and the pay-per-views didn't really connect the way they do today. But like, he has a decent showing in the Rumble. He's in at number one. He lasts for a decent amount of time. Like, Ric Flair, we're getting onto a different show entirely now, but I think he comes out of the 92 Rumble pretty well, to be honest. So we should probably talk about this match. One other thing. I am assuming, Mark, when would you have first seen this? Is it another one of the this week's?
Yeah, it was Saturday. It was Saturday.
I shouldn't laugh anymore. Like, I should know that every WWF classic, the answer will always be at some point within the last 7 to 14 days.
Well, it's different perspectives, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's interesting that, you know, we were looking originally through, you know, teenagers' eyes, kids' eyes for me, and then, you know, Mark, you know, very recently. So, you know, you've got a lot more kind of, what would I say, Mark? You've got
I've got double teenager's eyes because I'm twice as old as the oldest teenager could be.
Oh, yeah, or jaded as well. Not necessarily jaded, but you're not looking at it through just kind of very pure, you know, childlike eyes. You've seen a lot of...
No, yeah. And you wouldn't also perhaps have like a mist of nostalgia that Alan and I might look at it through.
Yeah, I was probably more... Not critical, analytical.
Yeah, that's probably a good word.
That's a better way of saying it, yeah.
And it's fascinating because at my heart, I think I'm an emotional wrestling fan at its best than an analytical fan. But this is a match where I was more analytical.
Hmm.
Whereas if I'd have seen it as a child, I probably would have had more of an emotional collection.
Hmm. So the version Mark and I watched is from the Bret Hart DVD. So because it's Bret Hart's DVD, Davey Boy's entrance gets cut off and we start with Bret entering the arena. However, Davey Boy comes out with Lennox Lewis waving a huge Union flag, as far as I remember. Despite it being Bret Hart's thing, Vince is immediately confused by Bret leaving the ring to give a kid his sunglasses. Davey is first up, shoulder blocking Bret clean out the ring, and off the platform it's sitting on in the center of the pitch. Wrestling rings in the UK for the WWF always have to go on a platform, don't they? It doesn't matter what the building is, the building owners are always scared of the floor getting scuffed in some way. Like, yeah, I can understand at Wembley, like to protect the hallowed turf or whatever. But I went to one night only in the Birmingham NEC, and I'm like, for Christ's sake, it's the Birmingham NEC. How bad can you scratch that floor?
Yeah, I'm not sure why they would necessarily just in the UK, you know, present it slightly different in the US in terms of that. Mm. I think there is other examples of that as well. And we know that stages on the top of wrestling rings aren't always good for the talent as well. There can be injuries.
No, let's ask Rick Rude about that.
Yeah.
The inverse of the not wanting scuffed floors. Have any of you seen Currican Hall when there's not a wrestling ring in there? Because the floor is like... in significantly brighter and more brown in the spot where a ring isn't. It's hilarious.
Just it's a completely different colour. So Bret comes back with an O'Connor roll and a small package for a pair of near falls, and you've kind of set up the power versus speed dynamic from the beginning. He whips Smith over to the mat with a headlock takeover, and we immediately establish the mat structure, which is... usually, Bret gets a hold on, Bulldog escapes, they run the ropes, do a high spot, and go back to the hold.
Mm.
Davey catches Bret on a leapfrog like he's a small child, it must be said. Like, he just catches him midair and doesn't move, and then catapults him into the corner, and Bret took that really hard. I know he likes slamming his sternum into the turnbuckle, but he smashed into that thing.
I love that catapult. That was, like, almost the best catapult I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's definitely a go-to Davey Boy Smith move is doing that catapult as well. Mm. He used it quite a lot around that time. It's a good face manoeuvre. So it's just that dynamic slightly different here with its face versus face. And I was kind of reflecting on that. And if you look at this match, you know, in isolation, it might not really tell kind of a story. But Vince was definitely more open to face versus face matches at this time because we had on the same show, we had Warrior versus Macho Man. And also at WrestleMania 8, we had Roddy Piper versus Bret Hart. So they were more open to it. I think before that, the last one was probably WrestleMania 6, a couple of years before. So it's interesting looking at this match as, you know, there is always going to be a subtle heel. You know, in that, and it would make sense. That's obviously Bret, you know, in this occasion. So some of the moves, so some of the selling Bret did was slightly more to me heelish selling or a little bit more pronounced selling than necessarily would do in other matches.
I think throughout the match, you can see he's leaning into it. He's always subtle, but he leans into it because the thing is, you say it's face versus face. It is. The crowd makes Bret a heel because the number of times, and we'll come to this, I think, in a minute, the number of times Bret does something that in a US, with a US audience, if Bret did that spot, it wouldn't have got a reaction. But because it was against Bulldog, the hometown boy, perfectly legal moves were getting booed heavily.
Oh, yeah. I mean, case in point, like up pretty soon, like he does a perfectly legal knee to the gut as Davey Boy comes off the ropes and gets booed out of the building.
And I think it's from there you can kind of see his reaction and it's kind of, you can always see him twig, okay, I can play subtle. But as Alan said, he feels subtle heel and it works perfectly for the match.
And I like the way he started the heel stuff off. It starts with him. So Smith's got him in an armbar and Brett pushes him back into the ropes, but he doesn't have his arm on his chest. What he's got is he's got his hand over Davey Boy's mouth and chin, and he's pushing him back like that, pushing his head back as well, which, you know, babyface Brett wouldn't necessarily do. So Smith gets a really nice crucifix for a near fall in between applying armbars of varying technique and quality. Vince calls a Manhattan drop a reverse pile driver, and I'm just surprised it wasn't a what a maneuver. Smith does the crucifix a second time, but Brett turns it into a Samoan drop. Brett loves that spot. Vince does call that a what a maneuver.
What I like, and this is something that as I'm seeing more Brett matches, I'm spotting this. Brett is a fan of the trope of a wrestler does a move once, he tries it again, and the opponent realizes and catches him. And I think he's probably done that in every match that we've covered in this podcast, and especially, as you say, that crucifix second time into a Samoan drop, because that was from both of the Kurt Hennig WWF matches.
Yeah.
One thing, and this is quite a random aside, the referee, Joey Morella, when he's checking these holds, I don't know why he gives me vibes of Ed Miliband.
Yeah, he does look a bit, doesn't he, there? I can see that now, because when I rewatched the match specifically again for the show here, I wanted to know, well, I looked out, who's the referee here? Is there a backstory? I mean, it's a sad story for Joey Morella. He passed away a couple of years later, less than actually, it was July 94. But yeah, Gorilla's son. But it was definitely that slightly bouffant hair and slightly dazed yet wild-eyed look, I'd say, that Ed Miliband had. I can see the resemblance, Mark.
I'm going to try and keep this on track, much like Bret Hart. Brett gets Davey in a chin lock, very clearly communicating spots directly into the back of his head. Brett gets the fish face on that Mark loves so much. And I thought he actually looked more like Kirby, like any closer to Davey's head, and he would have sucked him in and absorbed all his powers. Smith gets a little offense with a monkey flip kick off the rope and a couple of corner whips, but Brett starches him in the face with a boot as he charges in and a running bulldog, but he gets caught on the top and thrown to the mat. Bulldog, though, misses a headbutt off the top rope and winds up out on the floor. Wembley is booing the absolute shit out of Brett, and he has done almost nothing heelish and certainly nothing illegal.
No, he hasn't done. And, Bulldog didn't often go to the top rope in this era. And it hit something. So it was kind of a bit clunky. Bobby Heenan on commentary was good, because throughout this match, he was kind of, you know, leaning into these guys, a family, this family's stupid, blah, 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 blah. It jumped out to me that Bulldog's facials in this match, like we touched on at the start, Kieran, very blank. So there's no fire from Bulldog really in this, in any of the comeback spots. He wasn't showing a fiery baby face. He was carried a lot by the crowd himself. The crowd willed him in this. He didn't really kind of, really acknowledge them too much, even in the even at the end. And I think that hurt this match slightly for me. So in the spots where, Davey Boy would get that little bit of comebacks, the hope spots back if, Brett was on top, he didn't play to the crowd during them. He was very, blank. We know why. Some of this was he was scared. I think some of this he was overwhelmed. Some of this was like, I'm not sure what I'm doing here. I'm slightly out of my depth.
I mean, could you do your job in front of 80,000 people watching you? I know I couldn't. And that doesn't involve anything physical.
No, and not especially when we're on a big bender, well, no. Pharmaceuticals or otherwise. But it was a heavy show. I know that Hawk also was off his head the night before.
Yeah.
And he was kind of much carried through his tag match, which was less hard for him to do that than this. But I think if Davey Boy came in and he was straight, I think, we've got a great match here. We would have had an absolutely legendary match.
Oh, one of the little things is just watching when he's in the chin lock, because there's a lot of chin locks, understandably. We know why there's a lot of chin locks. But whenever he's in a chin lock, he tries to half do one of these, raise your arm in a kind of, I'm hulking up, as it were, or that kind of, get behind me. But they're so flaccid and so lackluster and almost not even nonchalant. It's just like, it's like his arm's just moving with itself. And it's like, it just gives that image that he's so checked out or not quite on the par, because it's like, I would like to think that that is quite a simple thing for people. I would like to think that a lot of wrestlers who are obviously, because he's obviously listening to Brett cluing him in, but I'd like to think that's kind of like something you can do without having to concentrate, just move your arm while talking. I mean, I'm doing it now and it's like I'm completely uncoordinated.
Yeah, but I would imagine you're more full of dinner rather than crack at the moment.
Oh no, I've got the hand-eye coordination of a dead stoat, but that's beside the point.
So, Davey is too close to the ring for the plunger that Brett is going for, so we end up with the invention of the slingshot sling blade, that honestly, I can't believe nobody has stolen as a regular move.
I called this a proto sling blade. The only thing better than this is Diana Hart's face afterwards with this amazing what the fuck was that reaction.
Yeah, there's various degrees of that throughout the match. So they'd go to a little window in the corner where
like she's doing an inset promo talking about her match this week. Yeah
with her infamous brown cowboy jacket on there. But I think she was quite good in some of her facials, so she was selling what was going on in the ring, and you could believe it was genuine concern from either of the competitors. But she was slightly, to me, in doing that, still in favor of the Bulldog. So when Bulldog made comebacks, she was, you know, more emotional, more emotive than when Brett was doing, which was fine. But it was good that she played her part. And I think, you know, she didn't detract being in that corner. She wasn't kind of doing too much. It was subtle enough where it didn't distract from what was going on in the ring.
Yeah. Mm. But she appeared a lot. And I'd like to think that someone told Vince when he said he was running in the UK, someone told Vince, you know, that Diana's popular in the UK. And he didn't ask which Diana.
Yeah, that'd be someone else if that other Diana was there.
So Hitman runs Smith into the post, flings him back into the ring for a hard corner whip, Russian leg sweep, forearm uppercuts, and a drop kick that's just two heavy feet in the face. There's none of this pretty tips of the toes Okada stuff. Like, Brett wants Davey to know he's there, possibly in shoot as much as in kayfabe.
As in to make him bump.
Yeah. There is a big backdrop that does indeed look like Hart is backdropping a fridge as Vince plugs a Lennox Lewis versus Razor Ruddock boxing match for Halloween night. If you're interested, Lewis went over by TKO in round two. Brett hits. I love the way Bret Hart does a vertical suplex. Like, he seems to pivot around a different part of his body to the way everybody else does it. And he's usually doing it on one leg as well.
Yeah,
I think it just, his form is so nice.
Yeah, it's that kickoff on one leg. And that's honestly, for someone that posts plenty of GIFs on Twitter, that's an easy one for people to appreciate. You'll always get good engagement just posting just a simple suplex. And that just goes for Bret Hart's kind of style versus others, where just a, you know, regular move, you know, Bret Hart just does it in a slightly different way, slightly different technique. And we saw different wrestlers do this for varying degrees of success. You know, Rock's kick, you know, they'd flick his ankle first before he put the kick in.
Yeah.
You know, that was different to a normal stomp. So it's good when wrestlers do that. They put their own slight little nuance on it, and you know it's them when they do it.
Also, considering that that Brett's having to basically walk Davey Boy through the match, this is part of a really nice sequence where they're telling the story that Brett is working over the back because he's taken advantage from running Davey Boy into the post on the outside. And it's like, you can tell that even when Brett is obviously in panic mode is maybe the wrong thing, but he's obviously thinking of things that he didn't think he had to do before the match.
Yeah.
Because he's got more pressure than he expected. He still has a coherent story.
I don't know about panic mode. I think he is possibly in a worse mood than he would have been had Davey come in clean. Like, if he was, not even clean. Like, you can be completely clean and forget everything you're supposed to do for the next half an hour, you know? I think if Davey was more able to hold his end up in that regard, I think this match would have been different in content as well as execution, perhaps.
Yeah, that's one of the things. It's like Brett's putting the focus that he has to have for his side of the match normally, but he has to put that extra level of focus. And I think everyone's had a day at work where they've suddenly had to be thinking of something else on top of their normal responsibility.
Yeah.
And afterwards you feel extra drained.
Yeah.
And it's probably that kind of thing.
Yeah. So we get the backbreaker, we get the pinpoint elbow, but it's to the back of the neck because Davey's face down and in the wrong place. And now Brett is resorting to punching the back of the head and hair pulling. And I, you know, this is technically illegal, but I'd cheer anyone who tried to pull that terrible white girl on holiday in the Canaries hairstyle off Smith's head. I always forget he had the braids. I think they're horrible.
Hang on, that's what Brian Alvarez many years later rocked as well.
Same goes for Brian.
Yeah, not a great look. I know there's a lot of commentary around that time, especially on this show as well, where there's comparisons. Or Bobby Heenan said, did Whoopi Wolf Goldberg
yes.
do his hair?
Yeah. You know,
so well. There was a lot of that time.
Whoopi Goldberg or Ray Charles. Hart gets a sleeper on. Smith crawls to the ropes and Brett kicks him in the face a couple of times. He lays across the bottom rope. In his book, Brett says this was to make sure Davey was awake enough in time to do his comeback and the finish. Sleeper number two for the 2.5 drops of the arm spot. And then Davey gets Brett up on his back and runs him backwards into the buckles. Hart clamps it on for a third time and Smith runs him into the corner again. And this time you can see Brett's neck very obviously slam into the top turnbuckle and his head snaps back. And then as Smith steps forward, I mean, it's going to be part sell, but Brett just kind of collapses to his knees in the corner and holds the back of his neck. It looks so rough.
Yeah, that was one of the roughest spots. I think that was one where he looked like he could have got hurt, but which wasn't his fault. The one where it also wasn't his fault, but he delivered the move, was that proto sling blade to the outside dive.
Because Smith kind of ends up on top of him, doesn't he?
Yeah, which was more his fault for not being in position. Yes. But they were the two spots in this match I thought could have, you know, been, if unlucky, could have gone wrong.
What about the gorilla press where Brett more or less falls into the ropes?
So that was an old Hart Foundation versus British Bulldog spot they do towards the end of a match.
Oh, was
where
it?
Davey would sell exhaustion by staggering backwards and dropping Hart on the ropes. Unfortunately, there were additional factors here, and Brett misses the top rope and just sort of ends up getting dropped on the middle rope.
I still think it looked good. I think
it does.
Still,
yeah, it looks fine. I mean, as I said like earlier on, like by this point, they're at the point where they can sell exhaustion.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, as a cover for whatever is going on in anybody's brain chemistry at that point, I suppose.
I genuinely think it was actual, real exhaustion from Bulldog. You know, he was sucking air. You know, the last 20% of this match, you could just, if you looked at his stomach, he was sucking air. So I think some of that was down to just genuine exhaustion, where Brett's was more selling. I mean, it was quite a long match. So over what normal pay-per-view matches are, even some main events, you know, they don't go, what was this match length?
This is like 26 minutes, I think, something like that.
So it's fairly long. So it was definitely money's worth for the fans.
Mm, certainly. Three bulldog clotheslines and a press slam for a pair of near falls, followed by the trademark delayed suplex for a third. Another off a chest burst buckle bump, and then he lifts Brett up into the running power slam, and Wembley is very happy about this. Brett, though, kicks out at two, and the place is screaming. Hart escapes an outside-in suplex and hits his very rarely seen German suplex, which for years and years I had only ever seen him do to Davey Boy Smith. I think he does one to Steve Austin at Survivor Series 96. But for ages, I'd only ever seen him do it on the Bulldog.
Yeah, I think he did one against Sean at WrestleMania 12 as well in the Iron Man match.
Oh, that might be it. I know it's in one of the matches we've covered on this show so far.
Yeah, his form isn't as good as others. There's no getting on your tiptoes as far as the Hitman's concerned when he gets in it. But it still looked good. It still looked effective. And I think actually Vince called the move correctly as well. Called it a German suplex on commentary.
Wow.
I thought wow at first, but I thought, to be fair, there's been German suplexes in the WWF in the 70s. Some wrestlers would do them. Carl Gotch was tag team champion. Vince would have seen him. So I think it wasn't too alien, but still, well done, Vince, for actually not maneuvering the maneuver.
So Smith comes back with what I can only call a graceless superplex. There is he gets no height and no distance. Like this is worse than Steve Austin's at Survivor Series 96. He just sort of flops back off the turnbuckle with him. Yeah. Vince says we've seen just about every wrestling move there is to see, and for 1992 WWF, he's probably about right, to be honest.
Yeah, there was plenty of, like we said, there was the German suplex spot. Brett would bust out slightly different moves from time to time, like you said. And this was a good match for it because, you know, Brett, if he's doing a straight Brett match, has his patented moves that he does. It's nice when he's in a longer match and a longer setting, he will try different things or things not necessarily you've seen for 2 or 3 years in matches. So
yeah,
he can bust out other things to, you know, tell a longer story. So, you know, this match had that. So it was better than the average WWF match at that time from a, you know, an actual in-ring maneuvers match type thing.
Yeah.
And I'll say it's something that I've noticed on the matches that we've covered on the podcast, and I appreciate. It's like the more I watch of Brett, the more I appreciate. But I'll get onto that in a few minutes.
So they double down off simultaneous clotheslines, and we get the spot that Brett allegedly woke his wife up at 3 a.m. to try. He claims he woke her up and persuaded her to lay on the floor so he could make sure this worked. He shuffles up on the mat and laces his leg in between Smith's and then rolls him over into the sharpshooter. Bulldog drags himself to the ropes for a massive pop, and now they're even. Brett's kicked out of the running power slam and Davey Boy has escaped the sharpshooter. Hart gets in one more uppercut and runs the ropes, hits a sunset flip, but Bulldog sits down, grabs Brett's legs and folds forward, pressing his forehead to the mat for the pin, and Wembley goes berserk. And I will say for this, what I said for the Magnum versus Tully episode, everybody who has seen this finish will never forget it. Like, for me, this is the defining image of this match. It's ever since I think even before I saw it, even though I'd only seen clips of it, because it's like, it's a reversal to the sunset flip you don't really see very often, if at all. If you see it now, it's in homage to this.
Yeah, it was good for what it was. You're not seeing a finish like this much in WWF at all. And it was good that it was a sort of flash finish, you know, rather than, you know, the power slam. I like the fact that Brett kicked out the power slam. I don't think that happened before then when David Bowie was a singles wrestler when he came back in late 1990. I think the move was pretty much protected.
Yeah, Vince says that on commentary, but like, I've learned not to trust Vince McMahon on commentary or wrestling commentary in general, to be honest, when they say things like that.
Well, what I love with after the kick out, Brett does a good job of selling the damage and selling that it's still like a tough move. He just had enough to kick out, but you could see that he was off, and there was a lovely spot where Davey Boy hits this slightly cocky kick, and it's like there's not a lot to the kick, but Brett's so out of it that he just goes down anyway, which I think is a lovely sell job.
But the pop, wow. What a pop. Yeah. I think the heat throughout this match, actually, to be fair, and it's not spoken about a lot. I mean, everyone goes to The Rock versus Austin, you know, in terms of kind of crowd invest, not Rock versus Austin, Hogan versus Rock, sorry.
Yes.
At WrestleMania, is that match where the crowd was invested throughout. Things were mic'd better, you know, later on than it would have been here. You know, they're in a foreign, you know, country as well, so they might not have had the same production. But it still came across on commentary to me that was a damn hot crowd.
Well, yeah. So I don't know if it was on the version you watched, Alan, but the one that Mark and I watched, there is the pop, and then you can immediately hear the audio engineer have to knock the faders down a little bit so as not to blow the equipment.
Yeah, you've got an ear for that, obviously, with your background. But yeah, I definitely noticed that on the. I watched the YouTube copy that WWF threw up a couple of years ago.
Oh yes, it's on YouTube, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, so it's easy for anyone to watch there as well. But yeah, the audio I think was very similar. It would have broken a few speakers if they hadn't have leveled it off.
Absolutely.
The two things I want to quickly say about this crowd is one. It reminds me a little of the 1980s All Japan women's matches in that the voice of the crowd is very different to a lot that we're listening to because it's very clearly a younger voice. You can tell that a lot of the crowd are younger fans.
The other thing I would add in there is the thing that always gets, I don't know why, I think it's because I'm watching WWF/WWE production. I'm never used to a British accented crowd chanting when it comes to like WWE stuff.
Yeah, I don't know if I prefer it when they try and put a quasi-American accent, very similar to the the little girl that we now know that everyone thought was a boy at the start of the show is going to win if he wants to or not.
I meant to introduce you with Alan's here to talk about this with us, whether he wants to or not.
Oh, yeah, you missed a trick there. But yeah, that was that faux voice that you'd put on as well there. But yeah, Bulldog did win, even if he wanted, you know, if he wanted to or not. And that was the irony of it all in the end. What does she know?
For me, the hidden star of the crowd, it's weird for me to say this, the person who brought the air horn, because for that crowd,
Ben Corrigan, it's so,
because it's so big, I think the larger a crowd gets, the harder it is to have unified chanting noise.
Yeah.
And having someone who's clearly like been to bigger sporting events or been to football events, who knows the rhythm to do for the air horn, the da 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 da, and then you chant.
Mm.
That's fantastic, because if it didn't have that, I could imagine the crowd sort of, other than the boos, struggling to have something to keep them going other than just general noise. So it's like, it's a rare case where I'm actually praising an air horn, but it works for this for this crowd and this scenario.
Yeah, the air horn was great. It's very much like, I don't know if you've been to shows with Andy Ogden, he can time his claps perfectly to get a crowd going. Honestly, if I was a promoter,
he can also pop an eardrum.
He can, yeah, he's very loud. But yeah, I can. If some British wrestling promoters have remarked to me that they love him in shows just for that, he keeps the crowd going in matches. Oh, yeah. He knows when, you know, the comeback's coming, clap slowly. But yeah, the air horn definitely added to this match, very much like the cowbell in Royal Rumble 92 the same year, if you remember that. We might see them at Wembley this year now. Not cowbells, but some air horns for the AEW show.
As long as they're not behind me.
Man force-fed own air horn. So Hart, of course, would be world champion by the end of the year, beating Ric Flair in Saskatoon. Smith drops the Intercontinental title to Shawn Michaels on October the 27th, but that match isn't scheduled to air till November the 14th, so he continues defending it on house shows. His last match with the WWF will be November the 8th, 1992, before being let go along with the Ultimate Warrior for receiving HGH shipments, just as Vince was under the gun for the chemically enhanced appearances of his performers. He'd be pushed near the top of WCW throughout 1993. Returned to the WWF in 94 after a short stint over here with All Star to help keep them going after Big Daddy suffers a stroke in December 93. There would be a heel run, a rematch with Brett at an early In Your House pay-per-view, a tag run with Lex Luger, and of course, the reformation of the Hart Foundation for the creatively hot and tense backstage period of 1997. Montreal happens, and then he's back to WCW for 98, where he gets seriously injured at Fall Brawl, the notorious bump on a mid-ring trapdoor that doesn't even need to be there. Somehow, he was back in the WWF in 1999 as a heel and would have his final match with them in May 2000. He was training for a comeback in 2002 and had a couple of matches teaming with his son in May 2002. But at the end of that week, on May the 18th, he was found dead from something we fans grew all too used to hearing around that time, a heart attack due to an enlarged heart. He was 39, only 39.
It's crazy how young he was, wasn't it?
But I know. Sad. Yeah. I know. And I mean, I don't want to like bring the show down, but we like that was a period. There was a 10-year period where it seemed like every month we were hearing somebody else had died from an enlarged heart. It was you kind of ended up getting used to it. It was horrible.
Yeah. You wait to get your observers. The observer wasn't online then, come to the post, you know, a few days later than the US guys got it, but you wouldn't know till you read that. And it was heartbreaking at times, especially someone that you know, was someone that you're generally a fan of, and you knew the backstory, knew the challenges. But it's interesting. He was only 39. The career that he had, you know, this was what, 2002, wasn't it?
His last match. Yeah.
Yeah. And he'd been in WWF, or he started in WWF in 84. It's crazy, really, that he started as young as he did. He was pushed quite at the top of the card.
I think he started in his first matches were like in 77 or 78. Like he was young David in the UK, wasn't he, for a long
time?
Yeah,
he was Big Daddy.
One of the Big Daddy partners.
Yeah, he was. Mm. And, you know, he pretty much gained weight quickly and, you know, grew in size quickly and went over to then Calgary and the rest is history. But that's pretty much it in a nutshell, isn't it, Kieran? His career at the end, he flip-flopped around. Yeah. He would always get chances, which was good. I think he was a proven commodity over years, but you know, at that end of the run, it was nice to have him on TV, and he was kind of the hardcore champion as well. Yes. He was aligned to Vince, but he wasn't a draw at that point. He was just another name on the card, wasn't he? He wasn't kind of stood out as someone special.
Yeah.
It was like an early WWF nostalgia type run at a time when they didn't do a lot of nostalgia. It was like that and the gimmick battle royal that was that year or the year after.
Year after. Alan, as our guest, and as you spoke effusively about it at the start, I presume you are still a huge fan of this match.
Yeah, no, I am a huge fan of this match. It's, you know, you can look at it now and critique it and say, you know, if David Boy was on his A game, it could have been better. It is that example of a real, you know, bona fide carry job. You hear it a lot now, but this definitely was one example of it. One of the more famous examples of it. And I think that's, you know, testament to Bret Hart that he could carry someone in a main event. He'd never main evented a pay-per-view before. So this was still a big deal for Bret.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so this would have been a co-main event. He was never positioned right at the top of the card, unless you're going to correct me, Kieran, and I'm missing something, but I think...
No, I don't think so. And I think for this show, like in the US, like Savage and Warrior was pushed as the main event.
Yeah, but this went on last, so it was co-main event. So as far as Bret was concerned, this is his biggest match for his career as well, in front of the biggest crowd he would have worked against. So it was a big deal for Bret, and I think... a lot of the wrestlers would have known this. They would have spoken. And I think Bret's respect levels with his peers may have gone up as well, that he got such a good match out of Davey Boy.
It's two SummerSlams in a row where he's carrying someone who shouldn't be in the ring. Because not only was like Kurt Hennig at SummerSlam 91 physically broken down, apparently he was also drunk off his tits as well.
Yeah, to get through the pain, yeah. Yeah, or so he said.
Yeah, he's like this. It's becoming Bret's thing. August is coming around, and he's got to perform miracles with somebody. Mark, how do you feel about this as the first timer and let's call it Bret skeptic of the show?
I said earlier, it's the more I see of Bret, and the more I see the context of Bret and the context of the US scene around Bret. It's like I 100% appreciate his skills, especially here where it's like. I'm noticing how he's leading the match, and I'm noticing a little bit. There was a touch at one point where he's actually looking behind him to check when he's hitting the ropes to tell Davey Boy the exact moment to push off from a headlock. And it's just, I get it. It's like, I don't think Bret will ever be a wrestler that I'll say, oh, I think he's one of the best of all time. I don't think he'll be a wrestler, or rather, I don't think he's a wrestler that I'll say he's a favorite because what I like and what I appreciate is not necessarily what he does. And he is a lot of wrestlers are a creature of their own times. And I got into wrestling at a faster pace and then the Japanese style, which is in general, a stiffer style, or was around this time. I think wrestling has become more homogenous the later it's gotten because people are watching the same tapes. I think this is another match that I'll say it's a great achievement, and it is a very good match, and I really do appreciate it. I think it's must-see because of the context, and it was something that I checked. At least half of the people who nominated this were British.
Okay. That makes sense.
I say at least half because the others had either had their Twitter account suspended or don't have any nationality, and I'm not going to be a creep and just reading for
let's English just say it was popular with British respondents.
It was popular with British respondents, and it is. I think for wrestling fans that watched wrestling in the 90s from Europe, I think it's a match that, for multiple reasons, made a big impression. And looking back without having any of that nostalgia, I can actually get why people nominated this from the 90s, because actually, objectively, it's a really good carry job and it's a very good match for what state Davey Boy was in. So it's like, I appreciate this. It's not a match that I'm going to want to see again, but it's like, I do get it with Bret. It's just not what I want out of wrestling.
Sure. Well, this is 4.25 on the Dave-o-meter, 9.12 on Cage Match. For me, I think it's a classic of its time. Much like the Hart and Hennig match we talked about last week, this comes from a time and place where quality in-ring work wasn't a priority. Mm. I mean, look at the rest of this card. Undertaker versus Kamala, Nails versus Virgil, Jim Duggan and the Bushwhackers versus Nasty Boys and the Mountie. Saying that though, like every 1992 WF pay-per-view had one or two good in-ring matches. Like you get the 92 Rumble, you get Hart versus Piper and Savage versus Flair from WrestleMania. You got this and Savage versus Warrior from SummerSlam, and then Hart versus Michaels at Survivor Series. So they were, I think it's because the smaller, more work rate focused guys were becoming more prominent within the company with the loss of like Hulk Hogan and his monster of the week ilk. The general in-ring quality just went up. But anyway, it's not like you got this every week. And for 80,000 people on that night, this was the best thing they'd ever seen.
Yeah.
And like we've said before, like a criteria for a must-see match is, does it work in the building on the night? And undeniably, this worked for everybody in Wembley Stadium.
Yeah.
Like it was, I mean, smart fandom was different back then. For 80,000 people, this was real at that moment, which I think is very important.
Yeah, absolutely. People I've spoke to that have been to the show, you know, they've got such vivid memories of this match. You can ask anyone who's been to the show and there'll be a slight smile or like, oh yeah, that crowd, man, I've never seen anything like it again. It's that a lot of people there, they will never have, you know, got that feeling back. And maybe they never will, but, you know, 80,000 people in London, that's a special time.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, if somebody was there told me this was the best match they'd ever seen or their favourite match, I wouldn't argue with them. There'd be no point arguing with them. I could completely understand it. This is also Brett doing for Davey what Kurt did for Brett the previous year, giving him everything but making him work for it. And, like really putting him over. As the next champion. And in that regard, like, I think this is better than the SummerSlam 91 match, if only because, I mean, Smith is more mobile than Hennig, and Brett and Davey know each other better as well, yeah. I think. Like, that, as I said, they've been wrestling each other off and on for 11 years at this point.
Yeah, they knew each other very well in the ring. And I think the kind of final point on the match for me is kind of, well, not the match, the outcome of it. Davey Boy only had the title for a couple of months.
Yes.
I don't remember any major defense. I think they would have had obviously some defenses on TV. I'd have to look up who against, but nothing stands out. Maybe a Skinner or someone like that on TV. And then he was pretty much gone in the promotion just over 2.5 months later. So for the amount of effort they put in, the crowd that they got, it was a bit of an anticlimax afterwards, unfortunately.
But it was worth it for this night, and it was worth it for the gate, I would imagine.
And no one thinks about that. No one thinks about what happens afterwards. It's that moment that everyone remembers.
Absolutely. Alan, it has been a delight having you on this week. Thank you so much for coming to speak to us. Please let everybody know anything you've got going on, you want to get out there, where you can be found on the internet if you want to be found, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so it's actually thanks to you both. I've really had a good time talking this match. Great memories. One of my personal kind of sentimental favourite matches, let's just say, rather than one I'm going to revisit often and tout to many people. It's been an actual pleasure being on, guys. You can find me on Twitter. That's my name, main hangout spot. I'm on at Alan_Cheapshot on Twitter. I post on forums from time to time, pro wrestling only. I lurk on, you know, Figure Four's forum and DVDR, things like that. Nothing much going on, so just give me a follow, but I'll definitely give you guys a few retweets of this show, that's for sure, as well, because I think there's more and more people probably should see this match that maybe haven't, maybe some more US fans.
I will, when this goes out, I will make sure I link to the YouTube version of this as well. If it's that easy to see, you don't have an excuse, really.
Exactly. Do it.
Yeah.
So, as for us, we are at Must See Matches on Twitter, Instagram, and Mastodon. I am at Kieran Edits, and Mark is
at Monkey_Buckles.
If you head over to linktr.ee/mustseematches, you can find all the ways to subscribe if you don't already, links to the full list of nominations, and a whole load more. I have a plug from the past and a plug from the future to get in. The plug from the past is last weekend, Andy Ogden and I dropped a new GCP where we talked about two more episodes of the high quality television show that is UWA Wrestling Rampage, plus the associated docudrama, which let me assure you is quite the thing. If you want to see a man rob a bank, if you want to see Doug Williams acting like a teenager and getting nicked for spray painting corrugated iron, that is the place to go. And not recorded yet, but likely out by the time you hear this, will be the new episode of Days of Thunder, where I will be keeping Lee's seat warm for the week and talking about some 1999 WCW with Dave, which I am, at time of recording, tremendously looking forward to. Next week, Mark, you may be pleased to know that you're getting a break from the Hitman. We're just moving on to men who hit men very hard. Eamon Bell will be back to talk us through Samoa Joe and Necro Butcher beating the living shit out of each other, which, spoiler, I've never seen. So, thank you very much, everybody, for listening and supporting us. Come back next week for that. Thank you very much. Goodbye.